Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, Pardes alum. If you missed it, please check out our previous podcast entitled The Mother and Her Seven Sons. It's a talk by Rabbi Daniel Landes, the director and Rosh HaYeshiva of Pardes. On a different subject, please take a moment to consider a gift to Pardes. In the Pardes Beit Midrash, or study hall, Pardes students discover the timeless quality of an authentic Jewish experience of intensive long-term study. Pardes is non-denominational, open to students from all streams of Judaism, both men and women. Now is a time that needs a Pardes blend of rigorous study of the classic texts in a modern, open setting. Your generous support at any level will make a real difference. Please visit www.donate.pardesusa.org to learn how you can make a difference. Thank you. This week, Rabbi Schweiger discusses Parshat Vayigash. Rabbi Meir Schweiger is a senior faculty member of Pardes and serves as the Mashgiach Ruchani, the spiritual guide for Pardes. And now, Rabbi Meir Schweiger.
Before I begin this podcast, I would like to express my thanks and gratitude to all those who have responded so favorably to this podcast series. In particular, I was very touched by a site that was brought to my attention recently, Jews in Green. As someone who served in a combat unit in the Israeli army, I fully appreciate the difficulties of studying Torah while on active duty. So I am very happy that I have been able to somehow contribute to the spreading of Torah among Jews serving in their respective armies. So I would like to dedicate today's podcast to Jews in Green. I have five sons who are either serving or are on reserve duty in the Israeli army. And my fifth son is currently doing an officer's training course. So this podcast I dedicate to my son Mutzi in his course. Today's parsha is Parshat Vayigash, and I would like to pursue a theme which I began 2 weeks ago, which is the personality of Yehuda. And I would like to in particular examine how Yehuda develops to become the leader of the Jewish people. Let us begin by looking at last week's parsha. This is chapter 42. And the background is, the brothers went down to Egypt in order to buy food during a time of famine. Joseph, as the one who was in charge of distributing all the food, recognizes his brothers, but they do not recognize him. And then Joseph goes through a whole charade where he accuses the brothers of being spies and eventually takes one of the brothers, Shimon, as a hostage, as security, for the brothers to prove their innocence and demands of them that if they want to purchase any more food and get their brother back, they will have to bring their youngest brother down to him. And when the brothers come back to Jacob and tell him the whole story, and then empty out their sacks and discover that their money has been returned to them. This is chapter 42, verse 36. Jacob says to them, "What have you done to me? You have bereaved me. Joseph is not here. Shimon is not here. You will take Benjamin, and all of them will be upon me." And the simple reading of the text is, all of them will be upon me. The grief of all of them will be upon me. I will not be able to bear that grief. You will have broken me. And then Reuven steps up, ostensibly to take a leadership position. And he says to his father in verse 37, kill my two sons if I don't bring him back to you. Give him to me, and I will return him. And in verse 38, Jacob responds and says, my son will not go down with you, because his brother died, and he alone is left. And if an accident, a calamity will befall him on the way, you will bring down my old age in grief to the grave. In verse 38, it is interesting that it does not say, and he said, Jacob said to Reuven, or Jacob said to his son, which will be parallel to what it said in the previous verse, and Reuven said to his father. The omission of Reuven's name, or even the reference to him being Jacob's son, the omission of Jacob's statement being directed to him, indicates that Jacob is not really responding to Reuven. And there is a rabbinic comment which says that when Reuven said to his father, kill my two sons, Jacob's response is, what a fool he is. They're his sons and not my sons? How can he possibly say to me, kill my two sons? And of course we all realize that Reuven never intended that Jacob should kill his two sons. It is clear that Reuven exaggerated to make a point. I am so sure that I will bring him back, and I want you to be so sure that I am now suggesting something which is totally absurd, as a way of saying the same way that I am sure you will never come to kill my sons, you should be sure that I will return him. But Jacob does not respond to that. And I would like to point out two things here with what Reuven does. Reuven, as the eldest, feels the need to have to take a position of leadership. But what characterizes Reuven, which Jacob actually says in next week's parsha, in the blessings, is that Reuven is quick as water. He is somebody who's very impulsive, who feels he needs to act. He's very well-meaning, but he doesn't think through his actions. He doesn't think through his comments. And perhaps another thing, which is important in this context, he also doesn't think through the timing. And what do I mean by that? When the brothers come back and tell their story, when they discover the money which has been planted in their sacks, there is this fear, this trembling, the sense of being set up. Jacob responds by saying, I don't want you to take this son. It will destroy me. It would be very reasonable to assume, given the circumstances, Jacob is not prepared to hear anything at that moment that will convince him to let Benjamin go. So no matter what Reuven would have said, Jacob would not have been responsive. So that Reuven's failure of leadership is, number one, a failure of timing, to know when to say something, when not to say, when to act, when not to act. But beyond that, what he says, even though well-intended, comes out being foolish, ridiculous. It is not a comment that you expect from a mature, responsible leader. And then we're told in chapter 43, in the very first verse, and the famine was very heavy in the land. And when they finished eating the produce which they had brought from Egypt, their father says to them, go back, purchase for us a little bit of food. And then in verse 3, and then Yehuda says to Jacob, but the man told us in no uncertain terms, do not see me unless you bring your brother with you. And then he says, if you are willing to send our brother with us, we will go down and buy for you food. But if you don't send, we won't go down, because the man said to us, do not see me without your brother. Let us examine the difference between Yehuda and Reuven. The first thing is that Yehuda waits for the opportune moment to speak. What is that moment? When the famine is heavy, when the food is almost ended, when right now they are on the verge of a crisis, when things are beginning to get desperate, when perhaps it's so desperate that Jacob is the one who takes the initiative and says to them, go and buy a little bit of food. And why does he say a little bit of food? This perhaps reflects maybe the desperation that Jacob is feeling. Maybe if all you get is a little bit of food, you won't have to bring Benjamin. Maybe you can somehow sneak in, get a little bit, go unnoticed, and I can have, so to speak, my cake and eat it too. I can get the food without having to give up Benjamin. But as I mentioned a moment ago, this is an opportune moment for Yehuda to speak, because Jacob now is ripe for what he has to say. Because Jacob realizes he has to get food. And then it's a question of somehow negotiating with Jacob. And then when Yehuda speaks, there are two things which I want to point out. The first thing, both in his opening comment and his concluding comment at this stage, he emphasizes to Jacob, there is no way that we can see this man without bringing our brother. Forget about getting a little bit of food without Benjamin. It won't work. The man will not see us unless we bring Benjamin. And then he does a second thing. He tells Jacob, it's your choice. I'm not telling you what to do. You decide. But I want the two options to be perfectly clear. We can go down and buy food, but that means you have to send our brother with us. But if you are determined not to send him, then you have to realize we will not go down. Those are the two options. There is no third option. There's no possibility of getting a little food and holding on to Benjamin. And then note Jacob's response. And by the way, note also in verse 6, it doesn't say Jacob, but Israel. And Israel says, why have you acted evilly to me to tell this man that you have a brother? The moment that Israel says this. It seems that there is a done deal. In other words, he is not closing the door on sending Benjamin. And he realizes he may have no alternative. But as they say, he is kvetching. He's letting off steam. Upset at the brothers. Upset that he's been put in this position. But perhaps resigned to the fact that he has to do it. And then the brothers note in verse 7, the brothers say, well, the man asked us about our family and whether our father is still alive, and we told him, and how should we have known that he would ask us to send our brothers? That's what the brothers say. But then in verse 8, Yehudah says to Israel, his father, send the lad with me. Let us go. Let us live and not die. Us, you, and our little children. At this point, Yehudah doesn't give the choice to his father. His father has pretty much made the decision. So Yehudah then states in very clear terms, let us get going. Let us rise up. Give us the lad so that we should be able to live. And once again, he makes it clear to Jacob, the alternative is that we will die. And who will die? All of us. And he emphasizes the little babies. But then he goes on in verse 9 and 10 and says to Jacob, I will guarantee him. You will seek him out from my hand. If I don't bring him back and present him before you, I will have sinned to you all the days. Had we not tarried, we could have gone back and forth twice already. So what emerges? Yehudah now becomes very focused. As they say in Hebrew, tachlis. Very action-directed. He says to Jacob, now is the time to act. Now is the critical moment. We have no time to waste. In fact, we could have already been back and forth twice. If we don't act, we will all die. And the coup de grace is, I guarantee it. I personally guarantee it. If I don't bring him back and present him, I will have sinned to you for the rest of the days. I will have to look you in the face, day in and day out, and accept the consequences of my guilt. So what are the qualities of Yehudah? First quality, timing. Waiting for the opportune moment. And when that opportune moment presents itself, to then act immediately, to not delay, to also empower his father and say to his father, in the end, I am not telling you what to do. You make the decision. I'm giving you all the options, but I want those options to be clear. And the last thing is, I take personal responsibility for what will happen. The buck stops here. If anything happens to Benjamin, I will have sinned for the rest of the days with all of the implications thereof. And then we see in verse 11 that Jacob says to them, if so, then this is what I suggest that you do. Bring a gift to the man. Bring the money back. And then he says in verse 14, and may God be with you. Extend his mercy upon you before that man. And may he send your other brother with Benjamin. So that in the end, it is Jacob who makes the decision. And what Yehudah does is to actually empower his father so that his father throughout is referred to as Yisrael. Yisrael as the man of action, the man of destiny. Now let us look at the end of last week's parsha. The brothers come to Joseph, and they feast with him, they drink with him. The atmosphere is extremely positive. But then Joseph, when he sends them away, plants his cup in Benjamin's sack, has someone run after them, and when they discover Joseph's cup in Benjamin's sack, they are brought back to Joseph. And this is chapter 44, verse 15. And Joseph says to them, "What is this action that you have done? Don't you know that I am somebody who divines? Don't you know that I would find you? That I would be able to detect this crime?" And then in verse 16, Yehuda is the one to respond. And he says, "What can we say to our master? What can we speak? What justification can we give? God has found the sin of your servants. We will be servants to our master. We and the one in whose sack you found the cup." Note that when Yehuda says, "What can we say to you? What excuse can we give?" In effect, that's a way of saying, "We're guilty." But it's very interesting that he doesn't say that. He doesn't say, "We have sinned against you. We are guilty." He says, "What justification can we give?" Why does he do that? Because they really are not guilty. They didn't steal the cup. He knows it. He has no question in his mind of Benjamin's innocence. And therefore he's not prepared to say, "We are guilty. We are sorry." What does he say? "God has found the sin of your servants." The sin of his servants would seem to be the stealing of the cup, but it isn't. When Yehuda says that comment, he is looking back at the sale of Joseph. When he is speaking now, yes, he's speaking to Joseph / the Egyptian lord. But in reality, he is now speaking to God. He is speaking to his own conscience. He is now acknowledging something which perhaps he did not verbalize for this whole time. Selling Joseph was a tragic mistake. Not only a mistake, as he says it, it was a sin. And now God is holding them accountable for that sin. Which means that Yehuda sees what's happening now as fitting in with some divine plan of retribution to him and the brothers for the sin which they perpetrated against Joseph, for the grief which they caused their father. And he even declares the punishment. "We will be servants to you. Measure for measure, we sold our brother into slavery. We should now become slaves. Measure for measure to pay the price of our sin." This quality of Yehuda we noted 2 weeks ago in the story of Tamar. in chapter 38. In a moment of truth at the end of the story, when Tamar is being taken out to be burned, on the basis of the death sentence which Yehuda has decreed upon her, and in her final act of sending his signet ring, his special cloak, when she says, "The owner of these objects is the one who impregnated me. Recognize who owns these objects before I am about to be put to death. Recognize who is the father of my children." And at that critical moment, Yehuda says, "Tzadka mimeni." She is more righteous than me. Yehuda then and Yehuda now displays the quality which is critical to a leader. The ability to acknowledge making a mistake. But whereas in the story in chapter 38, Yehuda simply says, "She is more righteous than me," in this story, Yehuda is saying, "We sinned. Not only did we sin, but we have to now pay a price for that sin. We are being held accountable by God for that sin. And I am now decreeing the verdict, not on Tamar, but on me and my brothers. We should now be your servants." And Joseph's response is, Chalilali, in chapter 44, verse 17. "It would be a profanation to me to do such a thing, a desecration. It is injustice for me to do that. Rather, I will take the one in whose sack I found the cup. He will be my servant, and you will go in peace to your father." All of this was background to the beginning of our parsha. The beginning of our parsha is the crowning point of Yehuda. Very similar to the beginning of last week's parsha, which is the crowning point of Joseph. And so now let's look at this interchange between Yehuda and Yosef. In chapter 44, verse 18, the first verse of our parsha, "And Yehuda came near to him, and he said, 'Please, my master, let your servant please speak words in the ears of my master. Do not be angry at your servant, because you are like Pharaoh.'" The verse begins by saying, "And Yehuda drew near." And we find in a rabbinic comment in a midrash that drawing near can be an expression of reconciliation. And in fact, when we look at the simple reading of the verse, Yehuda is being very conciliatory. He is saying to Joseph, "Please hear me out." He begs him. He emphasizes again and again, "I am the servant, you are the master." In fact, it has echoes of the meeting of Jacob and Esav after 22 years, when Jacob approaches Esav. But it's very interesting that Rashi quotes a midrash that also sees in this verse a confrontation. And in fact, there is a midrash which says that coming near can also be an expression used when you come near in battle. And therefore, you have midrashim that say that Yehuda is in effect also threatening Joseph. Between the lines, the rabbis in the midrash see Yehuda threatening, accusing, saying to Joseph, "Don't be angry, don't be angry, because what I'm about to say is very harsh and accusatory." When he compares Joseph to Pharaoh, according to this approach in the Midrash, he is not saying that we accept your authority in the way that we accept Pharaoh's authority. But you behave no differently than Pharaoh. You are somebody who is only interested in the exercise of power, and we won't let you get away with it. And we go on to read in verse 19, where Yehuda recaps their history and says, "When we first met you, you asked us, do we have a father or a brother? And we told you, we have an old father and a brother, the son of his old age, and another brother who died. And then you said to your servants, bring down this other brother, let me see him. And we said to you, but he can't leave his father. If he leaves his father, he will die. And then you said to your servants, but if he doesn't come down, do not see me again." And if I stop here for a moment, what is Judah saying? What is Yehuda saying to Joseph? He's saying, we were upfront with you. Whatever you asked of us, we were straightforward. We told you the truth. We also explained to you the situation. But you did not act in good faith. In the words of one Midrash, when people come in the store to buy something, what is the talk about? Is the talk about the merchandise, about the price? Or all of a sudden do you start talking about all kinds of elements which are totally irrelevant? Do you have a father? Do you have a brother? Who cares? All I want now is to buy something. What difference does it make? So why did you ask us originally if we had a father, if we had a brother? And why should you be so insistent that we have to bring our brother in order to be able to buy food, to the point where, don't see me unless you bring your brother? What Yehuda is saying is, we were being very upfront. We were very responsive to you as loyal servants. But you wanted to have a power play. You wanted to assert yourself. Even to the point where we emphasized to you, bringing our brother will kill our father. But it didn't seem to faze you. Where is your heart? Where is your compassion, your decency? But then Yehuda goes on to say, when he went back and brought the food to his father and told him the whole story, the father said, please go, bring a little bit of food. And as we noted earlier, what wasn't said was, but don't take Benjamin. And then Yehuda says, but we told our father, there's no way that we can see you unless we bring our younger brother. And then Yehuda brings it to a climax when he puts in the words in the mouth of Jacob, you know that I have two children that were born by my wife. One of them was torn apart. I have not seen him since. And if you take this one, and an accident will befall him, my old age will be brought down to the grave in evil. And then Yehuda says, and now how can your servant go to my father without the lad? When my father will see that the lad is not there, he will die. And we will have brought him to the grave in grief. So what is Yehuda doing? Yehuda is trying to arouse Joseph's compassion. At the same time, Yehuda is also saying to Joseph, I accuse you of being insensitive, of being cruel. If you don't exercise your compassion, then your true face has been shown. And then if we just conclude in verses 32 and 33, Yehuda says, it is your servant who is guaranteed, the lad. If I don't bring him back, I will have sinned to my father all the days. Yehuda explains to Joseph, why is he in the forefront, arguing? Because he has personally committed to bringing the lad back. He cannot allow the lad to remain and be Joseph's slave. But the last thing which Yehuda does in verse 33 is to say, and now let me be in his stead. Let me be your servant. And let this lad go up with his brothers. Because I cannot go up and see the evil which will befall my father. The speech of Yehuda is exceptionally beautiful. On the one hand, he is conciliatory. He is trying to play on Joseph's humanity, on his compassion, to make him realize the tremendous tragedy that will befall Jacob if Benjamin doesn't come back, to arouse any form of understanding within Joseph and sympathy. But on the other hand, Yehuda also makes it clear to Joseph. He cannot accept leaving Benjamin. He will not go back without him. And as the rabbis read between the lines, there is a veiled threat. You have acted in a manner which is a power play. We will not let you get away with it. If push comes to shove, we will fight. And between the approach of reconciliation and the approach of confrontation, between the carrot and between the stick, there is the last line where Yehuda says to Joseph, take me. I am not asking you to go away empty-handed. I am willing to now pay a price for what happened. But take me. In every way, I am superior to Benjamin. And that way you can have your cake and eat it too. And that way you can feel that justice has been served. But under no circumstances, take Benjamin. It is very interesting that there are midrashim which then say that after Yehuda made this speech, he waits for Joseph's response. And then, when that response is not forthcoming, Yehuda displays signs that show that he's ready for war. There is a hair on his chest that pops out like a sword. Blood which is dripping from his eye. He roars, a roar which is heard throughout the land of Egypt, a roar that's supposed to signal to Hushim, the son of Dan, to come to his assistance. The two of them, the dynamic duo, who will destroy Egypt. And at that moment, Joseph breaks down and reveals himself to his brothers. What is it that causes Joseph to break down, to reveal himself? It is not the fear of Yehuda. It is much more the respect, the admiration, perhaps the love, to see how Yehuda is prepared to now put everything on the line to defend Benjamin. The same Yehuda who sold Joseph to be a slave is now prepared to fight to the nth degree to prevent Benjamin, the other son of Rachel, from being sold as a slave. And at that moment, it is appropriate for Joseph to now be revealed. What I've tried to show is how Yehuda develops into a leader. And let me recap. The qualities of a leader are the ability to know the right moment to act, to not jump the gun, but at the same time, to not lose an opportunity. We discussed this last week with Joseph. It is also the ability to speak in a very logical, rational way, not to shoot from the hip like Reuven does, kill my two sons, but to be able to present arguments that are rational, reasonable, that can be heard. When Yehuda speaks to Joseph, it is the ability to somehow balance being conciliatory, threatening, decisive, to make it very clear what your red line is, which you're not going to cross. And I would also add, to be able to back up your words with action. When Yehuda says to Jacob, I guarantee that I will bring him back, it wasn't an empty promise, but as we see in the beginning of our parsha, he is prepared to go to the nth degree to make that happen. And by the same token, when Yehuda speaks to Joseph, he makes it very clear that he will do whatever it takes to not let him take Benjamin. And the last thing, to be a leader means to take personal responsibility. The buck stops here. I guarantee his return. In that capacity, he says to Joseph, that's why I am speaking. But saying the buck stops here is not just saying, I guarantee it, but putting your money where your mouth is. I am prepared to now be in his stead. I will be the servant. And when he says earlier, vis-a-vis God has found the sin of your servants. Let us all be now slaves. It is the recognition that if we do something wrong, there is a price to pay. And we have to be prepared to pay that price. Those are the qualities of a leader. And I would like to end with the last point. Yehuda, through all of his actions, ultimately brings about the reconciliation, the reunification of the family. He brings about the revelation of Joseph, brings him out of the closet, so to speak, but ultimately is able to make the family into a cohesive unit. And we see this even more so in chapter 46, verse 28. When Jacob and his family eventually come down to Egypt, Jacob sends Yehuda before him to Joseph to instruct before him in Goshen. In many ways, Yehuda has become the acknowledged leader of the family by Jacob. It is the descendant of Yehuda, King David, who ultimately consolidates 12 tribes into a nation, who builds a capital, Jerusalem, and who lays the foundation of the temple, so that a true leader has to be somebody who ultimately is able to bring about unity. I specifically did not say peace, but unity. And perhaps this is a difference between Yehuda and between Joseph. Yehuda is also a leader. Joseph is also a leader. But Joseph is a leader who is second to the king of Egypt. It's as if Joseph is the leader of the family vis-a-vis the outside world. Yehuda is the leader of the people internally. He is the one who brings them together. And even though King David wages war against the enemies of the Jew, his major accomplishment is, as I said earlier, to consolidate the Jewish people from being 12 disparate tribes to being one nation, to laying the foundation of the temple, which becomes the focus of the Jewish people. May we merit to have leaders who know what it is to be personally responsible, who know what it is to bring about unity. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Schweiger. Your comments on the podcast are always appreciated. Please send your email to podcasts@pardesusa.org. As I mentioned at the start, your donation in support of Pardes and of the podcast would be greatly appreciated. Please visit www.donate.pardesusa.org for more information and to make your donation. Thank you very much. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.